Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav.
And with you, as always, is your co-host, Montgomery, who's actually purring right now, which is what you can probably hear, because he hasn't fallen asleep yet, and he's on my lap.
I see. I can't hear him.
Oh, that's probably good. That's good. He's being a good boy. How are you, Grundislav?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Ben? 304.
I'm great.
Who
that's me. At Ben underscore 304 on Twitter. Follow me. Shameless plug.
Yeah, while you're at it, at Grundislav Games. We might as well take care of that at the beginning, rather.
Yeah, that's done. That's done. You can email me as well. You can send me a personal message on the phone. If you want to talk to me, I'm Ben-304 on Skype. You're Grundislav Games on Skype.
Yeah, I think we're starting to sound... No, I'm just Grundislav on Skype, but I think we're starting to sound a little desperate, to be honest.
Be our friends!
We don't have any others!
Man, I got two people added me on Skype after the last podcast. It worked.
Yeah, I don't think anybody added me on Skype after the last podcast. Yeah.
Jeez, have a look at yourself.
anyway, what are we talking about today, Ben?
Oh, we are going to talk... We're going to talk about talking. But first, let's go quickly over the Oro games, because Oro has been a thing, and the results have been announced.
And we're waiting on this, but yes. For those
are you kidding me, dude?
We're like a week.
Man, have you seen any other coverage in the press of the Oro games?
We're not exactly the press, but yeah, sort of.
I'm currently pressing on my cat as though we were a button.
Okay.
So I am the press. Anyway, let's do this.
Okay, well, for those of you who don't know, the Oro stands for One Room, One Week. It's a competition that's held periodically on the AGS forums. But then again, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know about that already. But in the event that you don't know what AGS is, Adventure Game Studio, yes. So it's a competition that's held mostly for fun. There's no real prizes except the satisfaction of knowing that your game was held dear by everyone else. And
you made a freaking game in a week, man.
Well, that's true, yeah. So you have to make a game in a week, and to keep it small, it's encouraged to be one room only, but the definition of what a room is has kind of gotten fuzzy over the years. So you can make not just strictly one room, you can have like a close-up or something or whatever.
Well, man, it doesn't matter, you can have as many rooms as you want, but it has to be made in a week.
Exactly, it has to be made in a week, and the entries are submitted anonymously. So
people don't go, oh man, I don't like that person, I won't vote for him. Or that's the only friend I have, I'll vote for them.
Yeah, except in the case of your game and my game, it was pretty obvious who made them. So they kind
of... We covered that last podcast.
Yeah, you're right. Anyway, so let's talk about all the other games that are not in Oro.
Okay, so best game went to Educating Adventures of Girl and Rabbit, who also got best concept and writing, and that was by Pablo and Captain Nemo. And I have to say, I really, really, really love that game. I had no idea it was Nemo and Pablo's game.
Same.
Although now that I've played it, I'm like, well, obviously, totally it was their game. But it was a fantastic game, and it totally deserved those prizes. I thought it was amazing.
I do, too. It was clearly my favorite of the whole competition. I laughed out loud immensely at the slaps. And Nemo really deserves kudos for actually slapping his own face to get that sound.
Yeah. Oh, I just have to say before we move on, the little mini game at the end is one of the funniest ideas for a mini game I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so best sound music design went to Me or MI by Calico Reverie, and I thought that was a pretty cute little game. It had very clean and very sort of nice art, and it had a nice little gameplay idea where you're switching between two characters and sending items between it. So that was a pretty cool little game.
Yeah, I liked it too. I had no idea who made it. I thought it was made by someone completely different who actually didn't even enter Oro. Just goes to show you my powers of perception were lacking. But I was completely wrong on that count. But yes, it was a nice little game. I liked it. It was cute. I got stuck at the beginning the first time I played it, so I had to kind of quit when I was doing my first playthrough and then go back and finish it. And I'm glad I did, because it was a fun little game.
Yeah.
A lot of work went into it for a single
week. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, and I know you liked it because you switch characters and you play as a cat, so you felt right.
Best programming coding went to One Dungeon 1 Week by Chris, which was amazing.
Absolutely was.
Old school dungeon crawler in a single week. Amazing.
I was very impressed by this. And I also had no idea who made it. I thought it was a toss-up between Radiant and I don't know. But I was pleasantly surprised by this one as well.
Okay, can I just say, Alex McKenzie, also known as Scarab, who's been in my car with you and sung along while he was drunk, showed me the prototype, the tech demo that he had built for One Room, 1 Week. And I think that if he had finished his, he probably would have won the best coding.
Really? What did he do?
He built a ray casting style engine, like a Wolfenstein 3D style engine.
Oh, wow.
So and not only that, a dimension shifting one. So I've been nagging him to make a game out of it and sort of bounce some ideas off him to give him and go, dude, you have to turn this into a game. It is amazing. So yeah, so let's go over some of the other games.
Yeah,
I would like to talk about The Crystal Ball by Oryxon, because I thought it was an amazing game. I thought it was just the whole idea behind it was really cute. The setting was great. The whole idea was really unique and really special, and I think everyone should play that, definitely. Well, people should play all of the Oryxon games, but that one especially was really, really nice for me. So, yeah.
The only complaint I would have, or critique I would have, is that it clearly suffered from time constraints, because
yeah,
I felt like I was missing something, honestly, because I spoke with other people and they said that it was, you know, it was amazing and it was really cool, and I don't dispute that at all, but it just felt to me like it could have benefited from slightly different dialogue options. I would have to say that's the Oryxon game that I played the most. I played through that at least 10 times just to see if there was any changes, and unfortunately there weren't. But I think that if you know, what they were going for was... I would like to see more done with that. Like, I really...
You'd like to see some consequence, I guess.
Yeah, or I'd just like to see more of it, or more people, or whatever. I really like...
Oh, yeah, me too.
Able to like see the guy's wallet through the chair and like all that little techniques and stuff. That was really clever.
It was very fun. So yeah, The Crystal Ball is definitely one to check out, and it did suffer from, I think, a lot of ambition and not enough time to do it, and I think so did Tattoo Room, which I thought was hilarious. I thought what a fun and cute game, man. Tattoo and such pretty art.
Yes, Tattoo Room was delightful. I loved it, and I will confess that I really do wish that there had been a little bit more time to do stuff with it, too, because I purposely gave the guy all sorts of awful wrong tattoos, and he was...
Yeah!
But anyway, I gave him a fish head with skeleton legs, and he was happy with it.
Yeah, so that's fine, but I thought it was such a cute idea for a game, and I'd love to see that as, like, it reminds me of an old game that never got very popular called Gearhead Garage, where people bring their cars in and their cars are broken and you fix their cars up because they got all these sorts of weird problems and send them off. I'd love to see a game like that where people come in and go, oh, I need a tattoo of this, and you have to sort of, yeah, old man.
Well, they clearly were going, I mean, they had so many options with, you know, how much to charge and
yeah, it was fantastic.
And stuff like that, just little things to change the guy's mood, which is great.
The fact that they did all of that in a single week, man, please turn it into a full game, because I'll play the heck out of it.
I will too.
Okay.
I will too.
Good. We have Betrayal by Bowler Puck and another person who I don't even recognize their name.
Neither do I, but Matthias Niemand.
Yeah, but I thought that was pretty cute. It had some nice dimension shifting gameplay, which I was like, and some of the puzzles were pretty clever being worked in with that, so that was nice, shutting doors and stuff like that.
Yeah, I liked the mechanic of walking around and shutting doors and opening up new areas depending on what doors you shut and stuff. I was kind of a little... I found the story slightly hard to follow, but...
Yeah. It was a little surreal, but other than... Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not about story. Well, I suppose story does play a big part in Oryxon, but if you've only got a week, you're not going to have a big, amazing, deep story. I mean, look at The Addict. Which, I mean, I think I have to say it's pretty great that someone sees a One Room, 1 Week competition and goes, yeah, I'm going to make my first game in that. So,
yeah.
All man, that's pretty great. So, big congratulations to the guys that made The Addict. But,
yep.
But you know, I think they're also a little bit insane wanting to make their first game in Unreal. I can't help but admire them. And I thought the attic was pretty funny. You know, the whole setup was pretty funny. So
It is admirable, too. I have to confess, I didn't get too far in the attic because I didn't know what was going on. I mean, the starting off on the toilet amused me, and the whole talking to God thing, and then God answers back, and I was like, okay, this is interesting. And then I was really confused, and I was like, okay, I'll come back to this. And I never actually got back to it. But I do admire and appreciate the fact that they made their first game in One Room, One Week. And it's definitely a good way to start and a good way to practice. And
lots of ambition if you're willing to go, let's make my first game in 1 week. And another game that had lots of ambition was Sinking by Wham and Ghost. I was like, as soon as I started playing, I just thought to myself, what the hell? Who tries to make this in a week? So yeah,
that was
well done, Tommy. And I'm not sure what Ghost did on that, but whatever he did, well done to those guys for like just going, hey, I'm going to build an insanely, you know, ambitious game like this in a week. That's great.
Yeah, I didn't get too far in that one either, mostly because I wasn't very good at it. I just kind of
it's pretty hard.
Yeah, I jumped around and I talked to the guys and they were like, ah, stuff's happening, ah, sub-sinking, ah, and I was thinking, oh my god, and then I fell on my face and it took him like 10 minutes to get up and then I thought, oh my god, I'm the terrible captain, and then I died.
I think that's one of the joys behind the game is it really makes you feel like you're in an emergency situation, so.
Yeah.
If nothing else, it does that really well.
Yeah, true.
I was a little bit disappointed that Limping Fish's flypaper never turned into anything more than it was, although that's obviously the joke behind it. But
well, yeah.
But yeah, Limping Fish, make a game. It's been a long time. Let's do it.
He has made games. But yeah,
he makes lovely, lovely, lovely stuff.
He really does. And also, I know it's a joke game and everything, but Comic Sans, unforgivable.
Yeah. Oh, I quite like Comic Sans.
Well, yeah. We'll give him a pass on that one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a funny joke. It got a big laugh out of me.
Did you laugh at Jack Trekker?
Jack Trekker's introduction is probably the best thing I've seen in HS in a really, really long time.
How ridiculous is that?
I don't want to know, and I think the mystery behind why a woman in a black dress needs to have little X pasties. But you know what? I'm glad she does, and I'm glad that she dances, and I'm glad that Jack Trekker bops his head around and takes her in his car.
And a camel trips over.
The game won my heart alone just for that intro. The gameplay was fun, and it was fun. The puzzle that it had with the hieroglyphs was pretty
fun. I really liked that. That was real fun. Yeah.
I felt really satisfied after solving that puzzle, but
I was surprised how much stuff got put in that game in a single week. That was insane.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Man, that's a common theme. These games are so ambitious.
I was really surprised not only by the quality of the games, but by how many people submitted games. It's probably 15
entries.
Yeah, 15 entries. I think that's the most entries an Oro has ever had. I could be wrong, but.
Yeah. Oh, and also, and don't forget Draconis, which another extremely ambitious game that must have taken forever to code.
Oh man, yeah.
Because I thought when I started playing it, I thought, oh, it's a little game where you walk a dragon around and then you do the thing, and all of the stuff starts falling down. I'm like, holy crap, who coded this?
Yeah, I only got to the second level because it was hard.
It's a puzzle. Yeah, it's not a little action game. It's a puzzle game. You really have to plan your way through the levels, I think. So
yeah, you really do.
So yeah, Radiant's actually talking about how he's going to expand the game a bit. So he's obviously got plans there. So
yeah, Radiant's good at doing those types of platformy stuff in AGS.
He did Indiana Rodent for the bake sale, which was another. Yes. That's a lot of coding work. So good on him for going, hey, I've got a week. I'm going to make something insanely ambitious.
I have to say, I was pretty sure it was a toss-up that either Draconis or One Dungeon, One Week was Radiant's game, so I sort of had an idea of what was going on there.
The one game that I absolutely knew who it was Kanji Gakusei.
Yeah, see, I didn't.
I knew who that was, because, see, I know how Cat draws, because I've played stuff like Sheep Quest, and I love Sheep Quest, man, that was great, and I know how Cat draws, and And I know that she's studying Japanese, so I was like, oh, well, obviously this game's Cat. So I was a little... I was a little biased when I'm playing that, because I'm like, oh, yeah, it's Cat's game, you know? So that, yeah, I thought it was pretty cute. There was a couple of little tough puzzles, but I think some of the puzzles... I laughed at the cat.
That was my favorite part of the game, when you feed the cat the fish and he just immediately slides over and stays asleep. Yeah. That is such like a cat.
That is such like a cat. And I have to say, I was like, oh, Cat, you're putting yourself in your game. Don't do that. Everyone will know it's you anyway.
It was clearly you.
Hush, you told me that you knew straight away who did the butler, the butler didn't do it. I didn't know at all, although I thought that was a pretty funny game. There was a lot of comedy.
Yeah, it was good. But for me, the dead giveaway was the music, because I recognized Zach and Noah's voices. Okay. So
That was a fun soundtrack. A quick way to make the soundtrack, you know.
That song got stuck in my head, I swear. I heard
it. Doesn't it? Yeah, me too.
Because it took me a while. But yeah, the game was pretty funny. Although, I mean, everyone said about, you know, the little kind of iffy walk cycles and stuff, but whatever, I mean, not walk
you
cycles.
You do get stuck. Area. It is a little frustrating at times when you get stuck.
It's easy to get stuck. Yeah, and I had to restart because there was one hotspot that disappeared because I did something else.
Okay.
I closed the closet accidentally and the bone hotspot disappeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But aside from that, it was really funny. The dialogue was funny and it was silly. And the ending was pretty funny too. It was a twist.
My favorite bit about the whole game, I say, despite all the comedy and all of the funny story and everything like that, was the fact that when you click on an object, it turns into an inventory item on your cursor, so you can ask anybody in the room about any object. I thought that is what I really took away from that game. I thought, what a great idea! It reminded me of Resonance, where you can ask anybody about anything.
Yeah, that was definitely.
I think we've covered all of them, although speaking of Resonance, have you played Vince's Molly Jam game that he never ended up entering in Oro because of the fact that he talked about on Twitter and broken the anonymity rule?
Yes, I did.
Man, I thought that was fantastic. I really like that. So good on you, Vince.
Yeah, that was creepy, I have to say.
I like the way that he designed the whole thing. It's very elegant because he took very, very, very few elements and still managed to make something not only cohesive but also deep and very playable out of it.
Yeah.
So good on him. And good on him and good on Limping Fish for doing sound for it. So Limping Fish entered a proper game in Oro in spirit, even though it wasn't in Oro and even though he did the sound for it.
See, I didn't know that Limping Fish had done the sound for it, so that's cool.
Okay, surprise. I'm pretty sure it was. I'll feel terrible if I'm wrong. Hang on, I can find out. Look, the power of the internet compels me. I must find out now. But yeah, I really liked Vince's game, even though it never sort of. Obviously, being Vince, he wasn't going to do something unambitious. That's not Vince 12 style. So.
No. The fact that he showed up everyone and did it in 48 hours, I mean, that's just.
Yeah.
That's Vince for you.
That's how Vince rolls.
Yep.
But yeah. But yeah, so if you haven't played Vince's, if you've played the Oro games but you haven't played Vince's Forest, go and play Vince's Forest because it's great, and he's probably made as much of a game in 2 days as everyone else made in a week. Damn you, Vince 12.
Yeah, damn you, Vince 12.
We seem to damn Vince 12 every podcast. That's going to become our thing. Vince 12. Yeah.
He should be our little mascot. Like, we should probably get a dartboard, a virtual dartboard, and put his face on it, and every podcast throw a dart at it.
But his face is so endearing.
Yeah.
I look at his face and go, oh, look, it's Vince 12. How the hell did a man with such a nice, friendly smile make a creepy as hell game like this one?
Well, because it's always the ones you least expect.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the closet killer. The butler didn't do it. Vince 12 did it.
Exactly.
Anyway, so, Oro, good. Yes, that was fun. That was nice. What have you been doing anyway, Grundersleff? What have you been doing with your life lately?
Oh, what have I been doing? I've been working on my game, A Golden Wake, and I've been ordering lots of old games on eBay, and I've been preparing for my move to New York in less than a month.
Oh, my God. Wow. Do you know what I've been doing?
Let me guess. You've been working on freelancing work.
Yes, and working at my real job, and also playing lots of games.
Wait. Be right there. Okay. You just said, and working at my real job.
Yeah.
Don't give me that nonsense.
Look, here's the thing. Here's the thing about doing game work. mm-hmm. right, for freelancing. When you love it that much, it doesn't feel like a job.
Ha! Okay. Well, maybe it doesn't feel like a job, but you're doing work and theoretically getting paid for it, so that means it's a job.
I don't know about this theoretically getting paid. I prefer getting actually paid.
Well,
I know what you mean. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, but you get. Yeah, I know.
This isn't Twitter. We're not complaining or anything. But my point is,
it's my podcast, and I'll cry if I want to.
My point is that I really dislike that stigma, if we can call it that. That making games is not a real job. That you know, people have. Okay, I understand that it's difficult to break into the industry or whatever, and it's certainly difficult to make your living off of making games only. But if you have more than one job, you know, if you're working at something completely different just to make ends meet, if you're working at Starbucks during the day and, you know, working as a tax accountant preparer at night, you don't say, oh, I have to go to my real job in the morning, or I have to go to my real job this evening. You have two jobs. So, you know, game design perfectly counts as a job.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair.
I mean, if you want to say what I think you're saying, you could say, well, I've also been working at the job that is tedious and work-like, and I can't...
I won't go that far. But yeah, no, so I've been working at my various jobs.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And I've been playing lots of games. I've been playing lots of first-person shooters from the 90s lately. I love first-person shooters from the 90s. I cut my teeth on games like Doom and Unreal and Outlaws, LucasArts Outlaws, which Ponch mentioned it after we did Top Scores, and I hadn't forgotten how much I love Outlaws, but it reminded me how much I love Outlaws. If you want a game with great cutscenes, great animated cutscenes, it's from the Full Throttle era of sort of LucasArts, so expect some great animation there. And I've been playing old id Tech 1 games like Hexen and Strife, and I finished Strife the other day, finished a playthrough of it, and one thing I really like about Strife is it takes all of the stuff that first-person shooters in the 90s all had, and it adds extra stuff. It adds a bit of stealth, it adds an open dynamic world, and it adds dialogue, and it also adds...
What a great segue!
And it also...
Exactly what we wanted to talk about!
Yeah, and it also adds a narrator who sort of like acts as mission control and talks to you, tells you what you have to do next. And one thing that I really notice is in games like Hexen and Doom, which I really love those games, you know, but you don't realize how lonely an experience they are when every single person that you meet is someone that you have to kill. And in Strife, all of a sudden, you know, there's this Blackbird character who's your narrator and acts as a character and actually is a big part of the story, and there's people to talk to. So dialogue in games is something I'm really fond of, and I sometimes forget how much I really like it.
It's actually, you know, I never thought about it that way. It's pretty sad to be a first-person shooter character because you're really lonely. You just walk around and kill everybody. You don't have any real people to talk to or have any meaningful conversations with except for your bullets.
Yeah, you know, when I started Far Cry 2, I got really excited because in the introduction sequence, you get picked up from the airport by a taxi and he takes you to the town. And as he's taking you to the town, he stops at a guard checkpoint. And to get you through the guard checkpoint, the guard has to bribe, the taxi driver has to bribe the guard guys with some beer. And I thought, oh man, that's fantastic. And I was really excited about playing this game and going up to guard checkpoints and being interrogated and having to bribe them with beer and stuff like that. But when I started playing the game, I saw a guard checkpoint, so I'm like, oh, there. So I walk up to them, and they started shooting at me straight away. So I went, oh, crap, I must have done something wrong. Was my weapon out? Was I running? What happened? You know, have I come from a hostile area? And I kept trying it with all these different guard checkpoints, and I realized that you cannot talk to any of the guards in the game. The introduction was a complete lie. There's no ability to do that, you know, so it really disappointed me that it showed this glimpse of interacting with characters beyond shooting at them and hiding from them, and then didn't deliver on that. So
that really is disappointing.
Yeah, so I love being able to talk to people in games, you know, so adventure games, which is what we kind of talk about the most,
Mm-hmm.
are really, really well known for dialogue and for talking. And there's a couple of different reasons why you have dialogue in a game, you know. Dialogue mm-hmm. can be there just to build a story up. It can be to flesh the world out, you know, establish more of the setting. And it can also be used for puzzles. So yeah, adventure games are really known for their dialogue trees, which are, I mean, you love dialogue trees. I love dialogue trees.
I have a love-hate relationship with dialogue trees, to be honest with you.
Why is that?
Well, on the one hand, I mean, there's two points of view. There's the designer's point of view, and there's the player's point of view.
Sure.
From the player's point of view, I enjoy dialogue trees that, like you say, help to establish the world, help to flesh out characters, help to move the story along, etc.
Sure.
I mean, there's perfunctory dialogue, which nobody likes if it's just the conversation that's like, hello, I am character X. I need
a key.
Yes, yeah. I need key. Bring me blue key. Goodbye. That's boring. Even if, you know, if it's just like, what's your favorite color? Blue. Then you think, okay, let's bring him a blue key. That's a little bit more clever.
Okay.
But from a designer's perspective...
Puzzle of the year.
Yeah. don't steal it from me, because I'm totally going to use it. But from a designer's point of view, it's really, really difficult to write dialogue that's not perfunctory. And that's not only not perfunctory, but also not pointless. Because, I mean, if you have a character who, you know, is a chef or something, let's say, and the whole purpose of this character is you need to take his meat cleaver from the kitchen, right? You'll expect that you'll, you know, if it's a comedy game or something, it'll be like, nice meat cleaver. And the chef will say, don't think about stealing it. And then, you know, you can be like, well, could I borrow your meat cleaver? And he'll say, no, don't take my meat cleaver. I'm an angry chef.
This is like a Let's Play where you're reading the dialogue. I like this.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess... I'm just making up this puzzle on the fly as I go.
I can hear that.
Its awfulness, by the way. So you have that as one dialogue option, one dialogue tree. The second dialogue tree could be something like, why is the window closed? And he'll say, well, because there's pollen in the air and pollen makes me sneeze uncontrollably. So then you think, okay, let me use this flower that I have and shake it at you. And he starts sneezing uncontrollably, allowing you to steal his meat cleaver. In that case, the dialogue option allowed you to, first of all, establish that he's not going to give you the meat cleaver and find an alternate way of getting it by the puzzle. Now let's say that there's a third dialogue option there where it's like, oh, do you like being a chef? And he proceeds to tell you his life story about how he attended cooking school and always wanted to cook things, blah blah blah. That's kind of boring,
right? It's kind of longest journey.
Yeah, it doesn't serve any good job bringing that one up, because we'll talk about that. It doesn't serve any purpose other than establishing a backstory for the character, which, to be honest, unless you're really invested in the world, doesn't really matter. I mean, most people are going to talk to the chef about what they need and not about his favorite color or his preferences for souffle toppings or anything like that, you know? So basically, it's really hard to come up with dialogue that is interesting and also serves a purpose, because you want to find that balance. Otherwise, it becomes the longest journey. Speaking of the balance, see what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the longest journey is notorious for having really, really, really long dialogue.
Yeah, it gets accused of logorrhea, and it's not just that. Yeah, logorrhea.
I like that. I never heard that before.
Okay. I think not only does The Longest Journey have a lot of text, I mean, I like The Longest Journey, but not only does it have a lot of talking, it's often delivered by characters with voice acting that's not the most endearing. And, you know, I mean, I am a very slow and patient, methodical gamer when I'm not playing Quake. You know, I really like to take my time and talk to everyone and explore everything like that. But there's a point, it gets to a point where I go, oh, come on. Get on with it, you know. There was There was even a point in Planescape Torment. I love Planescape Torment, but it is one of the wordiest games ever made. I believe there was an estimation that the game itself has about 800,000 words in it of writing, which is a lot, you know. I think an average paperback novel is about 100,000. I could be wrong, but Planescape Torment is hugely wordy. And there was one point in it where I was like, oh, man, I can't read all this. I need to come back to this later. So games will get you down. I know in The Longest Journey there's that bit where you're on the island and they've got the air creatures and you have to recount the stories to them. There's four stories that you have to go over and you have to, and I was just like...
It's funny you say that because I've played The Longest Journey twice and both times I've literally fallen asleep during that sequence.
Yeah, that's so slow. And I know you can speed it up with the escape button, but yeah, it still sucks. What are you doing? You've met Ragnar Tornquist. Next time, go up and say, hi, Ragnar. Hi, Rag. How you going, mate? We need to talk about... Yeah.
Hey, Raggy.
We need to talk about that. And also, why have you got that slash in the O in your name? What does that do? Does that make you... What is that? What does that do? Hey? Anyway, so look, I think, for me, I think non-essential dialogue is very good to a certain extent. I remember when I was making Airwave, and Airwave is set in a town full of people that the protagonist knows. And Sebastian was playtesting, and he said, you know what's really weird, Ben? He said, it's really weird that I'm walking around this town full of people that I know, and none of them ever say anything to me. So we actually incorporated, after he said that, we incorporated this little idea where if you walk into a room, there's a random variable rolled, and if it, you know, and if it's a successful check versus the whatever, I think it was 50% or something like that, then they'll just say some offhand remark to you, like, oh, did you go and see that concert the other weekend? You can say, oh, yeah, it was great. And that's it. It's like a 2-second thing. But as Sebastian said, it's really weird to be walking around, you know, this thing, and there's people that, you know, if you're walking down the street and you go past Sally, you don't just walk past and not look at Sally unless you're incredibly antisocial. You're going to go, oh, hey, Sal, how you going?
Yeah, or unless Sally did something naughty at the party last night and you'd rather not face up to it.
But... This is not confession time, Gonzalez. So I think it doesn't take much. It really doesn't take much to give a game just that little bit extra depth where all of a sudden it feels like there's these people that you know. And also, when you explore a world, there's two different things. I often think, when I think in terms of writing, I write the world and the characters separately, but the characters really have to build on the world, and the world have to really build on the characters for me. So I think each character that you talk to should expand some of your world just a little bit. Even if they're just going, oh, I need the orange key, they should be saying, you know, oh, I need the orange key, you know, to take back to the monastery in the hills, which has never been mentioned before. You can go, oh, wow, there's a monastery in the hills. Man, I'd like, you know, I'm interested. Yeah. So I think a lot of writers fall into the trap when they're making an adventure game is they grew up with Sam and Max and Monkey Island and Day of the Tentacle. And they go, I'm just going to force feed as many jokes into my thing as possible. And they get really forced. You know, and instead of expanding the world with their humor or anything like that, they're just going, oh, here's a joke I thought up. And I don't mind jokes, but if it feels forced, you know, I'm really not going to like it. But I think if you look at the Oro games, for example, I think stuff like Jack Trekker would have been, or stuff like The Educating Adventures of Girl and Rabbit would have been nowhere near as good without the dialogue. And that was all sort of, most of that was extra stuff, you know. You've got the three mummy heads talking to each other. I giggled at that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, I think, yes, don't get too carried away with how much extra writing you put in your game. I'm the biggest victim of this, you know, I'm the biggest culprit, I should say, because you only have to play some of my games and go, oh my god, get on with it, Chandler, you know. But, I mean, you even go back and play some of Dave Gilbert's early games. Dave Gilbert's biggest thing now is every time he plays the game, he's like, oh, man, the introduction is too long. Oh, it's too wordy. It's too this. I'm like, oh, what a hypocrite. Go back. Yeah. I hope he listens to this. Go back and play your old games and
Yeah, I remember, if we're talking directly to Dave Gilbert, I remember one
time.
Hi, Dave. I remember that at Mittens 2004, the very first Mittens I ever went to where I met Dave, when he was still working on Reality on the Norm games, he was doing one called Without a Prayer, which is a shame he never finished. Dave, go back and finish that game.
Yeah, what are you doing?
I know you're all big Wadjedi now, but don't forget your roots. Anyway, that game was very, very wordy, and he was showing it off, and I remember there was a scene where you walk into a room and there's a character, and he just walks into the room and starts talking to the character, and Dave's like, okay, let me just skip this dialogue, and he held down enter, and it literally took like 3 minutes for the whole conversation to finish even holding down enter, and everyone was like, oh my god, Dave, why did you write so much? He's like, I write a lot of dialogue. But I understand where he's coming from, because I've written very wordy games too.
Yeah.
And especially in the Ben Jordan games, I noticed that I fell into a trap which is very easy to fall into, which is when you have characters that the player talks to regularly, like sidekick characters.
Yes.
If the player goes and does something by themselves, like the player goes to, you know, infiltrate a temple or something and has an adventure by himself, and then he comes back and the sidekick character say, oh, hey, where have you been? It's really easy to have your player character start saying, oh, well, I went and I did this and I did this and blah, 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 and have him tell them what the player already knows because you went through it firsthand.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's an easy solvable problem by just having your narrator text say, you inform them of what has happened, or you start off with an end with an ellipsis and then fade out and come back in afterwards or something like that.
I think you can work your way around it through writing, to be honest. Yeah. What did you do? And you can go, you can say, instead of going, oh, I went and did this and then there was that, you can go that. You can say, oh, well, I got the key. Man, that place is big, you know. But I got out alive, you know. Right. So you can, man, if somebody asks you how your day was, you don't go, oh, man, well, I went and did this and then we did this and then I bought a sandwich and then we did this, you know.
Some people do that.
Yeah, well, this isn't Miami anymore.
What?
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, so I think I was talking to Dave and Janet about this the other day, about writing in games and long introductions, because I'm super guilty of long introductions. I like writing them, and I was like, oh, well, it does help establish a world. And as Dave said, he said, well, the idea is that you should establish a world through exploration. So rather than throwing it all at a player and go, blah, have my enormous backstory, let them find the backstory out for themselves by exploring. I agree with that.
There's a bit that I'm a little bit, I guess, proud of. I don't want to say too much because it's a spoiler for the introduction of A Golden Wake, but at the beginning of A Golden Wake, the very beginning, like the prologue, you are faced with a decision that you have to make. And the character, I wanted to express the fact that the character is being put on the spot by making this decision. So it's presented as a dialogue option to make this decision. And you have just started playing. You've spent about 2 minutes with this character so far. Maybe five.
Not even that.
Well, it depends. It depends on how quickly the player decides to go and speak to the character who gives him the decision. You can like walk around and look at things and kind of get an idea of what's going on. But it's right at the beginning, and you're faced with this pretty important decision. And so, not knowing anything about what the decision is going to do or what it has to do with, I think is a good way of putting the player on the spot and giving them that feeling of, oh my god, what's going to happen, and kind of like evoking that emotion that the player character is feeling.
Yeah. So what really got me when you got me to play it the very first time, I went, oh my god, how am I supposed to make this decision? Which I suppose is exactly how I'm supposed to feel.
Exactly. So there's different ways, little tricks of doing things like that.
Good. Well, let's talk about gameplay through dialogue. Obviously, a really classic example, a really obvious example, is the sword fighting in Secret of Monkey Island. I think that is a fantastic puzzle. It gets brought up all the time because it's almost like RPG grinding, except it's funny, it's cute, you know, and it's got a bit of humor in there. So that really set the tone for, I think, dialogue-based gameplay when it comes to adventure games, you know? It proved that you don't need to have inventory puzzles to make a game. I know when I made my exclamation mark game, my whole plan was to make interesting puzzles without relying on a single inventory item. So, you know, there's different stuff you can do with hints and stuff like that where you can incorporate a lot of gameplay into puzzle. You know, a person can have a certain quirk, like you mentioned, I like the color blue, mm-hmm. or something like that, and you can use that as a way to solve the puzzle. I think puzzles are, there's a few different stages to a puzzle. I always break it down into four stages. There's identification, so realizing that there's an obstacle there that you have to get past. There's observation, which is sort of checking out the various elements of the puzzle and going, oh, all right, so there's that, there's that, there's that, there's this item, there's that character, there's that thing. There's the solution where you go, oh, right, well, I need to add this to that and then do that on that. And then there's the actual execution where you have to go, right, now I have to actually do the puzzle. And, you know, depending on whether it's timed or it's got action elements or where it's a simple click thing on that, it can depend. So I think dialogue can help the most in the observation stage and sometimes the identification stage where you go, oh, look, these are the different elements of the puzzle. Oh, this character liked blue. I have to give him the blue key. You know, so, but it can also be, dialogue can also help in the other all four stages of a puzzle, you know. Sometimes a puzzle can be identified, observed, solved, and executed simply through dialogue. So,
man, listen to you. You're like a proper game designer. You have your little steps and everything.
Oh, yeah. I broke down puzzle design into four steps for myself years ago.
Wow. I just kind of make stuff up as I go along. Pretty apparent. Actually, there's something. When you write dialogue for your games, do you write it out beforehand, or do you kind of make it up as you go?
I do a bit of both. It depends. If I've got a scene, you know what it's like. When you're writing a story, you'll have certain scenes that you have to have in the game to make your story work how you want it. Yeah. So if I've got a scene, you know, the introduction, the ending, you know, a revelation, a plot twist, anything like that, I'll always write that out beforehand. Always. Mm-hmm. Because stuff like that, it takes a million different edits before it works for me. Okay. For me, you don't just write something and go, oh, it's written, you know. You got to go back and go, oh, man, that person sounds stupid. Nobody talks like that. You know, you sit there and you say each line out loud in character and you shorten it and you longer it and...
Yeah.
Yeah. But often if it's little jokey stuff, like little offhand stuff or, you know, stuff like that, I quite like writing on the fly. As long as I know who my character is, I'm quite comfortable to just sit down and just tap stuff out and then feel quite happy about it. So, yeah, I do a bit of both. I think it's both ways have their merits. How about you?
Yeah, generally I just write it all on the fly and then go back and tweak it later. I do that a lot more than actually sitting down and writing it. In fact, I can think of only two instances where I wrote out a conversation or just scenes in my games, and that was I wrote out the final scene of Case 7, of Ben Jordan Case 7, and the introduction of Case 8 years before I designed the games. Because they had to be very specific. And I also wrote out the final conversation with Cardinal Genovese for Case 8 beforehand. But that also had to do with the fact that I had a limited time to work with the voice actor, so I wanted to make sure I got it and recorded it and got the same guy again.
Yeah, okay.
So, but luckily...
That's kind of funny, because I always thought of you as a planned out guy. So.
No, not at all. I write all my dialogue out on the fly, and then I'll go back and do like what you said. I'll play
and
it. I'll edit it. I'll tweak it. I'll play the game, and I'll speak it out loud, and I'll see if it sounds. I imagine what it would sound like out loud, and if it sounds unnatural or stupid, then I go back and I tweak it, or I cut it all out, or whatever. But yeah, I do that, and I do all my room descriptions on the fly as well.
Oh, I do room descriptions on the fly as well. But often I'll do room descriptions with an idea of the world, so I know what the room description is going to be before I sit there and go, oh, how am I going to describe this? This is another thing with room descriptions. I think room descriptions, when you look at something, and we've probably covered this in an earlier podcast, but this is a pretty important thing for me. Don't have the player look at a chair and have the protagonist say, it's a chair.
Yeah.
That adds nothing. Say, oh, it's worn and battered, or that's a really fancy, that's a really expensive chair, you know. Have some adjective to make it worthwhile looking at stuff, or people are going to go, well, I'm not going to look at stuff in the game because it's pointless. I know it's a cupboard. Tell me if it's old or valuable or, you know,
whatever. Especially if you have a hotspot name thing and you hover your mouse over it and it says chair. You know it's a chair. Just have to make it interesting. But
although for the hotspot mouse that you hover stuff over, that's sometimes you can make that descriptive as well. I've done that. I've done that in Astro Galaxy Mega Quest.
Yeah. You can have little jokes with that as well, or do little fun things with that too.
Writing is fun, and writing is, man, people have been writing amazing things for thousands of years. Don't be afraid of writing amazing things.
Yeah. But going back to dialogue as gameplay, okay. I think that LucasArts games, LucasArts adventure games, are really the only adventure games that I can think of that really use dialogue puzzles.
Really? What about the end of the Shiver?
Well, I'm talking about games from the old school.
No, let's be open minded here.
I will be open minded, but I'm saying as far as games that pioneered that.
Oh yeah.
That's fair. Because Sierra didn't have dialogue choices. Sierra, the most you could get out of it was if you had the parser, you usually had, you know, ask about whatever. It kind of became dialogue trees with Quest for Glory, the VGA versions, where you could click on yourself and click on the other characters. You had dialogue topics to ask about.
Yes.
But LucasArts was really the one where you could see what your character was going to say beforehand. Even like Revolution games, for instance.
I'm trying to think if there's any dialogue puzzles in Beneath Steel Sky. I don't think there's no actual dialogue puzzles, although it is pretty important to.
I don't remember. Beneath a Steel Sky, you could select from sentences, right?
No, Beneath a Steel Sky, you can. It's like LucasArts; you can ask all different topics.
Right. That's what I mean.
You've got a dialogue tree, yeah.
Because that was Revolution, but Revolution also did Circle of Blood. I mean, well, Broken Sword.
Broken Sword.
Circle of Blood is known as
Lure of the Temptress.
Right, but in Broken Sword, the Broken Sword games, it was icons that were the dialogue, so you never knew what you were really asking.
Although Discworld and Sam and Max did that as well.
That's true; they did. But Discworld 2 had a dialogue puzzle with Mrs. Cake, if you remember, where she was all out of order and you had to pick the options in the right order.
Get her back. Did the Dig have icons?
The Dig had icons as well.
I thought the Dig had icons. So the Dig and Sam and Max both had icons rather than sentences.
Yeah.
I think I prefer sentences, to be honest.
Yeah, sentences. Sentences are good in the fact that, yeah, it's funny because you know exactly what the character's going to say, but it's also kind of weird to click on it, and then, I guess if it's voice acted, it's a little different, but if it's not, you just kind of, okay, you've already read the text because you know what you're going to pick, you have to read it again, you know?
That never bothered me. Can you imagine something like Curse of Monkey Island, not knowing which of the four answers he's going to give, and you're just like,
Oh, yeah.
That would suck.
Yeah, and a lot of people complained, like in the first episode of Tales of Monkey Island, a lot of people complained because it gave you lots of dialogue options, and no matter which one you clicked, you always got the same answer.
It's
a little sloppy. It works as a joke sometimes.
The first time, it's funny.
Yeah, but if you do it every single time, then it gets a little
that's
annoying.
That's dumb. It's very dumb. So, yeah, I think sometimes you get a game where it's like, you know, you've got a character and you get four options that are completely out of character for that character, and no matter which one you pick, it's going to be something, you know, that fits their character, you know.
Right, like, well, if I can do a little plug here, the Ben Chandler's Paranormal Investigator.
I forgot about that end, yeah.
Talk to the Bunyip, and then all these awful things, and then when you say it, Ben Chandler says, I'll be your friend, and shame on you for thinking I was going to say any of those things.
Dude, you've heard some of the worst things anybody's ever said in the world come out of my mouth. How did you write that? How did you think? Oh, I suppose in the game I portray a lovely character.
What else have I had come out of your mouth? It's horrible.
I mean from my real mouth, from when it's me deciding what I say.
I thought you said you've had it, but you said you've
No. You've heard some of the foulest things a human being could possibly utter come out of my mouth. How did you ever think that I'd portray a nice character in a video game?
Because I made the game before I spent 3 weeks with you.
More fool you, Gonzalez.
Well, hey, you know, I was trying to make the people more sympathetic. No one wants to play a jerk character.
No. No one wants Bogan Baz's Big Adventure.
But you know, we had the alternate theme song. We made up the alternate theme song. So, you know. Yeah. People have no idea what we're talking about. Let's move
people
on.
You know what people like? People like mystery. This is what we're doing.
You're right. I suppose they do. But about dialogue, here's the thing about dialogue puzzles, especially in LucasArts games. Very few LucasArts games allow you to die. And as such, when you have a dialogue puzzle that you have to navigate through the dialogue tree to figure out the correct response that will get you the puzzle solved, sometimes it suspends the belief or the realism if you can fail and then come back and initiate the same exact dialogue all over again.
Yeah.
There's a couple of puzzles that I can think of where you do die, like at the end of Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis is a dialogue puzzle. Where
Full Throttle, you can die.
Can you?
Yeah. Well, you die and then you go, let me try that again.
Which dialogue puzzle are you talking about, though?
Well, I suppose they're not really dialogue puzzles, but it's still selecting options from a list.
Oh, yeah, of course. I was thinking of a dialogue puzzle where Ben's tied up to the four motorcycles and you have to call Marine Diver Dynamo. See, that I thought that's a clever...
That's a great puzzle.
That is a fantastic use of the dialogue puzzle right there.
Yeah. Well done, Tipo.
Yeah, but also you can go back and repeat the same things again. So
yes.
It's a bit weird to have Marine keep saying, ooh, like what, when you've threatened to call her name. So,
anyway.
But you know, you have to. I guess you kind of have to compromise if you're going to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
If you're Jones in the Fate of Atlantis, you can die if you pick the wrong dialogue options.
Sure.
You're in a high pressure situation, I suppose. Which.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, dialogue puzzles. Gotta love them.
I think in the case of we're just talking about the puzzle with the being stretched by the motorcycles in Full Throttle. There's a case of a game where not only is it a puzzle that you have to solve, as well as an important plot point, because it's really a turning point in the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the fact that Ben stays so calm and collected under pressure, it really cements his character and who he is, you know. It never once feels, nothing that he says feels out of place, because they've established him as such a tough guy. You know, well, I mean, God damn, you've been smacking the hell out of bikers on the road, you know.
Yeah.
He's not the sort of guy that's going to go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, you know.
Yeah.
That's a really great example of a dialogue puzzle, because, yeah, it's a puzzle that you have to solve that's quite good to solve, because you have to remember what her dad told you. It's a great example of a plot point worked into a puzzle, and it's a great example of cementing, you know, or reinforcing a character through the use of a puzzle. Good on you, Tim Schafer. Finish your Kickstarter game.
I wonder if he'll listen to this podcast. I doubt it.
I think he will. I think he will. Hi, Tim.
Yeah.
How are you?
When he sees our brand new logo on iTunes.
Man, how can you not? How can you not? So dialogue is, for me, dialogue is a really important part of gaming. Like I said, when I started playing Strife, and I just finished a playthrough of Strife, great game. If you've not played Strife, it's a 1996 game by Rogue Entertainment, who went on to work with American McGee, who left id Software after Quake, or during Quake, I'm not quite sure. He left and he joined up with Rogue Entertainment, who used to work at the same offices as id, to make American McGee's Alice. Their earlier game is called Strife. Everyone's played Alice, nobody's played Strife. I think Strife is a better game than Alice. Go and play Strife, it's a great game.
It really
but
is.
Yeah, I ever played a demo and I played the full version of, well, I played Alice fully. And yeah, Strife is a better, what little I played of Strife was 10 times better than Alice.
Amazing. So, Strife goes to show that dialogue doesn't just belong in adventure games, you know? It belongs in all sorts of games. You've recently played Deus Ex Human Revolution. We've discussed
this. Original Deus Ex, yes.
And some of you told me some of your favorite parts about Deus Ex were the scenes where you, it's like an interrogation and you have to pick the right responses. Now, this is like an action game with shooting, and it's got stealth, and it's got open world, and it's got all these amazing things about it. And the thing, and it impresses me that one of your favorite bits about it can be a simple thing like a dialogue scene.
Yep, and it impressed me so much, the persuasion mechanic, that I completely stole it unashamedly and I'm using it in a Golden Wake, sort of.
Yeah. That's a test. That, for me, that's a real testament to the power of dialogue as gameplay, as compelling and interesting and fun gameplay, you know?
Well,
and personally, I found the dialogue bits in Human Revolution a little bit too random for my liking.
Well, they're kind of random, but also when there's an augmentation that you get that lets you read.
There is.
And
yes.
So that helps out a lot.
But yeah, so it really impressed me to know that this, because I really love that part of Deus Ex, and I would, you know, I love the fact that in Deus Ex, especially in the first one, you know, people will ask you something, like, I think when you finish the very first mission, someone will say to you, you know, oh, you went a little bit soft on them, or something like that, and your response affects how they treat you for the rest of the game, you know. I think dialogue can be just as compelling as any other gameplay element.
Well, because if you analyze the core psychological reasoning for it, if we can get deep here, talking to people is interesting. Not just in games, but in real life, talking to people is generally interesting, and finding out about people is interesting, and the ability to be able to persuade someone in a game and get them to do what you want, or you know, get them to give up some kind of information or something like that. It appeals to that to the gossipy side of all of us. I mean, how many times have you you'd be talking with a friend of yours or something. You're like, hey, what's up? How's it going? Oh, I'm all right. Hey, did you do anything interesting last night? Oh, yeah, I went to this party last night. It was pretty crazy. Oh, yeah? Well, what happened? Oh, I don't want to talk about it. Oh, come on, tell me. No, come on. You know, and then usually it ends at that, and you're like, oh, man, I want to know. But if you have a game, you're like, well, I've got 10 credits in my pocket that says, you tell me about the party. And they're like, I tell you everything here. This is what I did. And then you're like, yeah.
We'll try that on your friends in real life. So here, I have 10. Here, I have 10 M&Ms. I have 10 Jelly Ranchers. Apple flavor.
Well, I know how I can convince you.
Oh man, one apple jelly rancher would sway me. I can taste it in my mouth right now.
Wow.
If you get role playing games, you know, you don't play as many role playing games as I do. But I love games like Arcanum and Baldur's Gate and Planescape Torment, and I bang on about these games constantly. But the funny thing is I spend hours, you know, strategizing how I'm going to get through a dungeon and, you know, casting buff spells on myself before I go into battle so I'm ready for battle, you know, and I go, oh, you know, I'm fighting against ice enemies, I'm going to have to prepare fire spells before I rest and stuff like this. But when I play, I always, always, always give myself high charisma and high intelligence for the leader so that when I get to a thing where I have to talk to somebody, I can persuade them to do what I want, and, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Man, I played through Baldur's Gate as a bard, which is like the most ridiculous idea ever.
I have never played, so I don't know why that is ridiculous, but I'll take your word for it.
Great game, you should play it. Anyway, sorry?
Nothing. I was just going to say that one of my favorite bits in Fallout New Vegas, more so than in Fallout 3, because Fallout New Vegas was a lot more tuned to this, was being able to talk your way out of things, or talk your way past doing annoying things, because you have...
Yes! I love that. This really shows, you know, because here's the thing. when you think about gameplay and you go, oh, but just talking your way out of doing something's really boring, how is that any less boring than shooting people like you've been doing for the last 10 hours?
Exactly.
It's not. It's new and exciting, and it's a real sense of accomplishment because, you know, you've proved that you can do something that not every player of the game could do.
Even if it's something just as simple as getting, you know, extra money from
anything.
Somebody.
Anything, yeah. It's a reward. And you know, games are reward-driven experiences a lot of the time. Whether the reward is story or, you know, or reflex testing gameplay or anything like that, you know, games are reward-based. So it feels amazing to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. Dialogue is compelling gameplay as well as storytelling.
Well, this has been an interesting little dialogue that we've had.
Where's the? I'm looking at the dialogue tree in front of me now, going, "Where's the goodbye, Francisco? We've spoken far too much." Option. That's the one I want to click. Yeah. Where's my graphical user interface, please?
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Anyway, sorry, I got distracted.
Yeah, that'll do it for this week's pod. Well, I mean this podcast. I don't want to commit to too frequency.
Little lazy.
Yeah, no, that was a close one.
Yeah, dodge that bullet. Anyway, so yes, thank you for listening.
Yes.
We hope that you've either learned something or disagree with us that violently that you'll send us hate mail.
Yes.
You know, if you learned something, if you've got some thoughts to share, because I'm sure there are people who are going to go, oh, I don't agree with that at all. I want to talk about this. Or you didn't cover this point in depth enough. Be sure to leave us some comments. We go back to the start of the podcast where we talked about all the ways you can contact us.
Yeah. And also, you probably know this already, but our podcast is now available on iTunes. Just look up Blue Cup Tools. That's three separate words, Blue Cup and Tools. And you can find it and subscribe to our podcast. And if you don't like iTunes, you can just go to
the MP3.
Yeah, or just go to grunislavgames.com/podcast, where you'll find a link to the RSS feed, which you can subscribe to, and it will update you when we update a new episode. And Twitter usually is a good place to look to, because we usually scream about our podcast on Twitter as well.
And the AGS forums.
Yes.
Do you know what I like?
What?
Every time I see RSS, I go, arse. Goodbye.
Bye.